Welcome, curious minds, to the deep dive. Today, we're not just scratching the surface, we're plunging headfirst into a name that, well, just by its very sound, it conjures up this force of nature, Howlin' Wolf. Just hearing that moniker, Howlin' Wolf, you immediately picture someone powerful, maybe a bit primal, with a voice that could maybe shake the foundations of the earth.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder, you know, what kind of person, what kind of life, what kind of sound could possibly earn such an iconic, almost elemental name?
It really is a name that doesn't just describe, it sort of evokes something, doesn't it? It suggests a presence that's, well, beyond the ordinary, hinting at a life lived with this intensity that, frankly, few could match. It's almost like a mission statement in itself.
Absolutely. It really is. So prepare yourselves, because we're embarking on a deep dive into the extraordinary life and monumental legacy of Chester Arthur Burnett, the man far better known, of course, as Howlin' Wolf. We've pulled together articles, researched some really fascinating personal accounts to unpack the incredible journey of this man, born into the harsh, you know, segregated realities of the Deep South. He didn't just transform the blues. He carved this indelible mark on the, well, the beginning sounds of rock and roll, leaving an influence that still reverberates today.
And our mission today really is to truly understand the forces that shaped him. We're going to explore how his profoundly challenging early life, his, I mean, truly unique guttural vocal style.
Oh, yeah.
His surprising and, frankly, remarkably disciplined financial sense.
Which is fascinating.
It really is. And an almost relentless dedication to his craft. How all that combined to make him one of the most influential blues musicians of all time. We're going to discover some genuinely surprising facts about his personal discipline, his incredible path from being functionally illiterate to becoming this really business-savvy band leader.
Yeah.
And just the sheer tenacity that defined his entire remarkable career.
Get ready, because by the end of this deep dive, you'll understand how a childhood nickname, which was initially just kind of a playful scolding, right?
Right, exactly.
How that evolved into a global phenomenon. You'll grasp how one man's distinctive growl and howl didn't just define his sound, but actually reshaped an entire genre, influencing countless artists across generations, I mean, from the Rolling Stones to modern experimental rock bands.
It's quite rich.
It really is. It's a story of survival, incredible resilience, and just pure, unadulterated musical genius. And we're going to show you not just what happened, but why it mattered so profoundly. Hashtag #Tay1, early life and the genesis of a howl. Okay, let's start right at the beginning, at the very genesis of this legend. The man we came to know as Howlin' Wolf was born Chester Arthur Burnett. That was June 10th, 1910, in White Station, a small community near West Point, Mississippi. And kind of fascinatingly, he was actually named after the 21st U.S. president, Chester A. Arthur.
Yeah, that's a detail many might not know, especially when you think about the raw, sort of untamed nature of his later persona.
No.
And you mentioned his imposing physical presence right at the start, which is just so critical to understanding him. This wasn't something that developed later. From a very young age, he was, well, physically formidable.
Right.
Standing 6'3", weighing maybe 275 pounds as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
He earned nicknames like Bigfoot Chester and Bull Cow.
Wow.
This sheer size and strength, it undoubtedly played a huge role in how he navigated a tough, often brutal world. And it certainly contributed to that powerful, almost intimidating stage presence he became famous for.
Mm-hmm.
You can almost see him just owning any space he walked into.
Yeah, that physical presence is such a striking contrast to the instability of his early home life, isn't it?
It really is.
His parents, Gertrude Jones, who had Choctaw ancestry, and Leon Doc Burnett, who he described as Ethiopian, they separated when he was just 1 year old.
Just one.
This early instability, this sort of broken family foundation, it really set a difficult and often traumatic tone for his formative years. What were some of the most profound early traumas he went through?
Well, that's a really powerful point. The trauma began incredibly early. I mean, he was kicked out of his mother's house during the winter as a child.
In winter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This wasn't just a physical hardship. It was a deeply scarring experience that you can almost trace right into the raw emotion in his music later on.
Hmm.
The reasons why this happened, and they remain somewhat speculative, but each possibility paints this vivid picture of the harshness of his upbringing and the profound rejection he must have felt.
Right.
Sources suggest it could have been, well, maybe his refusal to work the fields, or perhaps a rejection of choir music in favor of the blues, which would be pretty ironic, wouldn't it?
Yeah, hugely ironic.
Or maybe his mother's new partner just didn't want him around. or even, and this is tough, his mother's perception of him being too dark in a society just obsessed with colorism back then.
And those reasons, refusal to work, favoring blues over choir, his mother's partner, or even his mother's perception of his darkness. I mean, each one suggests a different kind of burden, doesn't it? How much of that unresolved tension do you think fueled the intensity of his later performances?
Oh, immensely, I'd guess.
Yeah.
Regardless of the exact reason, this is a deeply scarring experience that clearly left a lasting impact. So after being cast out, he moved in with his granduncle, Will Young. But it was hardly an improvement.
Not much better, huh?
No. It was a large household, and he was apparently treated badly, as essentially used as free labor. He worked almost all day, every day, in the fields.
Hmm.
And received no formal education at all.
None.
None. Think about that for a moment. One of the foundational figures in American music, a man who would later earn an honorary doctorate, wasn't even given the chance to learn to read or write as a child.
God.
This lack of opportunity, this profound deprivation, it's a theme that runs right through his early life and profoundly shaped his character, his drive.
That lack of formal education is just heartbreaking, especially knowing what he achieved later. But the abuse he suffered, it eventually led to this really dramatic breaking point, didn't it?
It did.
When he was 13, in a fit of rage after one of Young's hogs ruined his dress clothes.
Yeah, imagine how precious those must have been.
Exactly. Burnett killed the animal. This act led to a severe whipping, followed by this desperate chase on a mule as he tried to escape.
Wow.
He then ran away, claiming later to have walked an astonishing 85 miles barefoot to finally join his father.
85 miles barefoot.
Yeah. And it was with his father that he finally found a happy home, a large, welcoming family. During this period, he even used the name John Dee, trying to actively dissociate himself from that painful, traumatic past. What an incredible act of resilience and self-preservation for a kid.
That journey, 85 miles barefoot, it's almost mythological, isn't it, for a young boy? And it absolutely speaks to his incredible, almost primal resilience, even at such a tender age. It shows you the kind of grit and determination he had right from the very beginning, just this drive to survive and find a better path.
Yeah.
And this brings us to the actual birth of the Howlin' Wolf persona.
Yeah.
Which, fittingly, has this fantastic and quite personal origin story.
It really is a perfect origin story for him. The name Howlin' Wolf didn't initially come from his powerful stage presence, like many might assume.
Right.
Instead, it came from his maternal grandfather, John Jones. Apparently, young Chester had this habit of squeezing his grandmother's chicks too hard.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. So his grandfather, maybe trying to scare him into being a bit gentler, told him that wolves would come and get him if he didn't stop. It's such a vivid image, isn't it? A mischievous boy, a scolding elder, and boom, the genesis of a legend.
It's absolutely perfect for him, a name that just stuck from childhood mischief. And the actual sound of the howl, that came from a fascinating musical evolution, too. He was heavily influenced by the country singer Jimmy Rogers.
The father of country music.
Exactly. Known for his distinctive blue yodel. And Burnett initially tried to emulate Rogers' yodel. But as he himself famously put it, I couldn't do no yodeling, so I turned to howling, and it's done me just fine.
Love that.
It wasn't just a clever nickname, you see. It was a descriptor of his unique, raw, guttural vocal style that would become his absolute trademark. It's almost as if his voice naturally found its most authentic, most powerful expression through that untamed, almost animalistic sound.
That transformation from attempting a yodel to perfecting a howl is incredibly insightful. It shows an artist finding their true voice even when it wasn't what they originally set out to do, you know?
Mm.
It wasn't an imitation. It was this authentic expression of his own physical and emotional landscape. And it really cemented his unique sound in a way no one else could replicate.
Absolutely.
On a more tangible note, a really significant turning point in his early life, a moment of profound personal agency, was January 15th, 1928. On that day, he managed to gather enough money, probably through grueling work, to buy his first guitar. This was such a monumental event for him that he reportedly never forgot that date until the day he died. It just speaks volumes about how important that moment was for his future.
So guitar in hand now.
Right. So with his first guitar in hand, we move into the 1930s, which was a truly crucial period for his musical apprenticeship in the, well, the fertile grounds of the Mississippi Delta.
Absolutely.
In 1930, Burnett met Charlie Patton, who was arguably the most popular and influential bluesman in the Delta at that time.
The king, basically.
Yeah. Imagine him, this young, aspiring musician, maybe still a bit rough around the edges, listening to Patton play nightly from outside juke joints, just soaking it all in. He remembered specific songs like Pony Blues and Smokestack Lightning years later, which is a testament to their deep impact.
And Patton wasn't just a performer. He became Burnett's vital mentor, a true master passing down his craft. He taught him guitar, with Pony Blues being the very first song he learned, a foundational piece of Delta Blues, right?
Hmm.
But just as importantly, Burnett learned the art of showmanship from Patton. Patton was known for this flamboyant, almost acrobatic style. He was described as turning his guitar over backwards and forwards and throw it around over his shoulders between his legs, throw it up in the sky.
Wow, really theatrical.
Totally. These were audacious tricks that Howlin' Wolf would incorporate throughout his own career, transforming him into this captivating, almost theatrical live performer. It was like a complete education, not just in music, but in stage presence.
That's incredible. Not just the music, but the stagecraft. It's fascinating how he absorbed not just the musical notes, but the entire performance artistry. This blend of raw sound and theatricality must have been just electrifying to see.
Oh, I bet.
Beyond Patton, he was also soaking up influences from a whole pantheon of other blues greats of the era. Mm-hmm. You got the Mississippi Sheiks, Blind Lemon Jefferson, Mulroney, Lonnie Johnson, Tampa Red, Blind Blake.
The list goes on.
It really does. He even mastered songs like Jefferson's Matchbox Blues. This really shows his dedication to learning and his wide-ranging appreciation for the blues. He was a true student of the genre.
Absolutely. And his dedication to learning wasn't just limited to the guitar. His distinctive harmonica style, for instance, that was directly modeled after Sonny Boy Williamson II.
Oh, okay.
Who actually taught him how to play when Burnett moved to Parkin, Arkansas back in 1933.
Yeah.
So we see this really deliberate and comprehensive apprenticeship happening here, learning from the best in both guitar and harmonica. He was building an entire arsenal of musical expression, honing the skills that would define his unique sound.
So by the end of the 1930s, Burnett was like a fixture in Delta clubs, a known quantity. He was performing solo and with other incredible blues musicians of the day like Floyd Jones, Johnny Shines, Robert Johnson, Robert Lockwood Jr.
Legends, all of them.
Right. He was often equipped with his harmonica and an early electric guitar, already kind of pushing the boundaries of the acoustic Delta sound, hinting at that electric future.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't all just music and camaraderie. He faced some seriously personal and dangerous challenges during this time. The Deep South was just a perilous place for a black man, and that reality manifested in a particularly grim incident.
That's a crucial point, and it truly underscores the raw, perilous realities of life for a bluesman in that era. Down in Hughes, Arkansas, while trying to protect a female acquaintance, he got into a fight with an angry boyfriend and tragically killed the man with a hoe.
Good heavens.
Yeah. The outcome of this incident is actually disputed. Some accounts say he fled the area. Others suggest he served some jail time. But what it absolutely underscores is the desperation and violence that could just erupt in his world. It makes his survival and eventual success all the more remarkable, really, given the constant shadow of danger and the precariousness of life for black men in the Jim Crow South.
That's a grim reminder of the brutal context he lived in. And then the 1940s brought this tumultuous interlude that dramatically altered his path. Military service.
Right. The Army.
On April 9th, 1941, he was inducted into the U.S. Army and assigned to the 9th Cavalry Regiment, one of the famous Buffalo Soldiers units, an all-black cavalry unit with a really storied history.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, he later stated that plantation workers, whom he had refused to work for, were the ones who alerted military authorities to his presence. So even his induction had this element of, like, forced labor and resentment behind it, a continuation of the oppression he faced.
Yeah, and his army experience was profoundly challenging, particularly because of that lack of formal education, which came back to haunt him in a really brutal way.
How so?
Well, basic training involved long hours of just menial work. At Camp Blanding, Florida, he was assigned to kitchen patrol, cooking by day, playing guitar by night.
Ah, of course.
Later, he played guitar on the mess hall steps at Fort Gordon, Georgia, where a young James Brown.
The James Brown.
Yeah, who was shining shoes and performing buck dances there, actually heard him play for the first time. Can you just imagine that historical confluence? A young James Brown unknowingly witnessing the raw power of the wolf. A moment of unrecorded but utterly foundational musical cross-pollination.
What an incredible, almost cinematic moment in music history. Unknowingly witnessing a legend who would, in turn, influence other legends. But his illiteracy, that deep scar from his childhood, caused him immense trauma during his service.
It really did.
He was sent to a tutoring camp in Tacoma, Washington, assigned the complex task of decoding communications. Because he was functionally illiterate, he was repeatedly beaten by the drill instructor for his errors.
Beaten? Oh, my God.
Yeah. This horrific ordeal led to uncontrollable shaking fits, dizzy spells, fainting, mental confusion. It truly highlights the profound impact of his lack of formal education and the brutal, dehumanizing treatment he endured simply for a deficiency that wasn't even his fault.
It's just heartbreaking, isn't it? And it's such a telling detail about the physical and psychological cost of that early deprivation. So, after an evaluation at an Army mental hospital, Burnett was found unfit for duty and honorably discharged on November 3, 1943.
Mm-hmm.
His reflection on the experience, though, sums it up. The Army ain't no place for a black man. Just couldn't take all that bossing around, I guess. The wolf's his own boss.
Wow.
That perfectly captures his fierce, unyielding independence and his deep-seated desire to control his own destiny, to never be subjugated again. That quote just screams howling wolf.
It really does. So after the Army, he returned to his family near West Memphis, Arkansas. He helped with farming, but crucially, never stopped his music. He kept performing, drawing on all those influences and experiences.
Right.
Then in 1948, he took a significant step, maybe emboldened by his Army experience and that desire to be his own boss. He formed his own band.
This was a pivotal moment for his career, yeah.
Yeah.
Marking his true emergence as a leader. His band featured guitarists Willie Johnson and Mad Guitar Murphy and harmonic player Junior Parker.
Wow, some lineup.
Seriously. This marks a crucial step in formalizing his musical enterprise, beyond just playing with others. He was now a band leader, shaping his own sound and vision.
Mm-hmm.
And to expand his reach even further, radio station KWEM in West Memphis began broadcasting his live performances, a powerful tool for building a local following back then.
Big deal.
Huge. He also occasionally sat in with Sonny Boy Williamson II on KFFA in Helena, Arkansas, broadening his local exposure and honing his craft even more, connecting with other giants of the blues.
Okay, so with his band formed and his sound really growing, we've arrived at a truly defining chapter, the Chess Years.
The big time.
Exactly. This is where Howlin' Wolf's sound just exploded from regional popularity to a national and eventually international force, truly helping to shape the electric blues as we know it.
Hmm.
The story of his discovery, kind of typical of the era, is legendary. In 1951, a 19-year-old freelance talent scout named Ike Turner.
Yep, that Ike Turner.
Already a formidable musician himself, heard Howlin' Wolf perform in West Memphis. This encounter was absolutely pivotal, a true turning point that would redirect the course of blues history.
It was a total game changer.
Mm.
Turner quickly brought Wolf to record for Sam Phillips at Memphis Recording Service, which of course would later become the iconic Sun Studio.
Right.
And also for the Beharry Brothers at Modern Records.
Yeah.
Phillips, a man with an incredible ear for raw talent, was just utterly captivated by Wolf's intensity.
Mm-hmm.
He famously said, "God, would it be worth on film to see the fervor in that man's face when he sang? His eyes would light up, you'd see the veins come out on his neck, and buddy, there was nothing on his mind but that song. He sang with his damn soul."
Wow, what a quote.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
That captures the visceral, almost spiritual power of Howlin' Wolf's performance.
Yeah.
You can just feel the energy he commanded.
You really can. You can almost see him there in that studio just pouring everything he had into those early recordings. Howlin' Wolf quickly became a local celebrity in Memphis, a powerhouse.
Hmm?
His first singles, Moanin' at Midnight and How Many More Years, were released on Chess Records, while others, like Riding in the Moonlight, came out on Modern's RPM Records. He was hot property, you know? Two labels vying for his singular talent, which is a testament to his immediate impact.
And that competition, it resolved itself pretty quickly, showcasing the shrewd business sense of the Chess brothers.
Right.
In December 1951, Leonard Chess successfully secured Howlin' Wolf's exclusive contract. At Chess's urging, Wolf made the momentous decision to relocate to Chicago in late 1952.
Big move.
Huge. This move wasn't just a change of address. It was a fundamental geographical and stylistic shift that would define the very sound of electric blues. Chicago became the new home for his powerful, electrified sound, where it could truly flourish in that bustling urban environment.
Once in Chicago, Wolf didn't just show up and expect things to happen. He immediately set about assembling an all-star band, really demonstrating his leadership and discernment.
Yeah, he knew what he wanted.
He recruited Jody Williams as his first guitarist. then, crucially, persuaded Hubert Sumlin to leave Memphis and join him. Sumlin's style, described as understated solos and surprisingly subtle phrasing.
Which is perfect for Wolf's voice.
Exactly. It became the perfect, almost telepathic complement to Wolf's booming, guttural voice. That lineup became absolutely legendary in the blues world, a true partnership that defined his sound.
And this is where we see his unique character and that shrewd business acumen truly shine, something that really set him apart from so many of his contemporaries.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Howlin' Wolf was known for a policy that was just almost unheard of among band leaders of the era. He paid his musicians well and on time.
That alone is huge.
It is. But he even went as far as providing unemployment insurance and Social Security contributions.
No way, back then.
Yeah. This wasn't just generous. This was a revolutionary practice for a black band leader in the 1950s. Most blues musicians of this era were systematically exploited by record labels, by managers, often dying penniless. Wolf's meticulous record keeping and his refusal to be taken advantage of made him this rare exception, a true pioneer in artist rights, long before the term even existed. It speaks volumes about his understanding of loyalty, professionalism, and the value of his own labor. A direct contrast to his own early hardships and the systemic exploitation he witnessed and endured.
That's a huge point. It wasn't just about having money. It was about wielding financial independence as the shield against the very forces that had marginalized so many others in the industry.
Exactly.
It allowed him to attract his pick of available musicians and maintain one of the best bands in the business, which directly impacted the quality of his sound, giving him artistic control.
Right. And a key collaborator during this period was Willie Dixon.
The songwriter.
Yep. Hired by the Chess Brothers in 1950, he became Wolf's primary songwriter, penning some of his most iconic tracks. And apparently, there was also this intense, almost legendary rivalry with Muddy Waters, who was another chess star.
Ah, the rivalry.
Oh, yeah. That rivalry was palpable. Friendly, maybe, but fierce competition that pushed both artists to excel. Dixon reportedly used reverse psychology on Wolf sometimes.
How so?
He'd introduce songs as if they were written for Muddy Waters to make Wolf accept them. Wolf, you know, with his strong personality and competitive streak, would often reject songs initially. But if he thought Muddy might get it, suddenly became appealing.
That's brilliant.
The great anecdote that really brings his competitive spirit and proud nature to life, reminding us that these weren't just musicians, they were complex individuals, right?
Totally. So, despite all this behind-the-scenes drama and fierce competition, the hits kept coming. Throughout the 1950s, Howlin' Wolf had 5 songs that reached the Billboard National R&B charts.
Pretty impressive for blues back then.
Totally. Moanin' at Midnight peaked at number 10. How Many More Years hit number 4, which is a significant achievement for a blues track. Who Will Be Next at number 14, Smokestack Lightning at number 8, and I Asked for Water, She Gave Me Gasoline, also at number 8. Those are some serious chart successes for a blues artist at the time, indicating his widespread appeal beyond just regional fans.
Absolutely. A testament to his undeniable raw appeal that resonated with a broad audience. His debut LP, Moanin' in the Moonlight, came out in 1959, compiling these previously released singles and really solidifying his place as an album artist.
Mm-hmm.
But the early 1960s brought forth even more classics, songs that would become pillars of blues and rock music.
Mm-hmm.
He recorded many of his most famous songs during this period, despite often getting little to no radio play outside of specialist programs.
Right.
Think about tracks like Wang Dang Doodle, Backdoor Man, Spoonful the Red Rooster, I Ain't Superstitious, Going Down Slow, and Killing Floor, many penned by Willie Dixon. These weren't just hits. They were foundational texts for future musicians.
And these weren't just blues songs in the traditional sense. They became blues and blues rock standards, eventually influencing countless rock bands who would discover them later.
Exactly.
His second compilation album, Howlin' Wolf, released in 62, even earned that enduring nickname the Rocking Chair Album because of its distinctive cover illustration. Such an iconic image in itself.
It really is. These records were laying the groundwork for something much bigger than just the blues charts. They were shaping the sonic landscape of an entire generation of musicians to come. Hashtag tag 4. Global recognition and enduring influence on rock.
Okay, so with these seminal records under his belt, let's talk about how Howlin' Wolf broke out onto the global stage, bridging that gap between the blues and the burgeoning rock scene, truly becoming a worldwide phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
During the blues revival of the 50s and 60s, this fascinating and critically important shift occurred. Black blues musicians, who had often been marginalized by mainstream American radio, found this brand new and incredibly eager audience among white youths, particularly in Europe, and then eventually back in America, too.
Right, the folk and blues revival.
And Howlin' Wolf was right there, among the very first to successfully capitalize on this demographic and cultural shift.
It was a pivotal moment for the blues, yeah.
Mm.
A crucial infusion of new energy and appreciation. And Wolf was perfectly positioned to ride that wave. In 1964, he embarked on European tours as part of the American Folk Blues Festival.
Wow, those tours were legendary.
They were, bringing his powerful electric sound to international stages for the very first time. This was crucial for establishing his presence beyond the American club circuit, proving his appeal was universal. European audiences, often less encumbered by American racial prejudices of the time, they revered these blues artists as living legends.
And here's where it gets really fascinating for rock fans, truly connecting the dots between blues and the British invasion. In 1964, the Rolling Stones, already huge rock and roll titans,
already massive,
recorded his song Little Red Rooster, and it shot to number one in the UK charts.
Number one.
This instantly highlighted the crossover appeal of his material and introduced his work to millions of new listeners who might never have sought out blues records otherwise. It was like a direct pipeline from the Delta to the global pop charts, courtesy of a band who openly idolized him.
And that connection deepened dramatically and very visibly in 1965. Right at the peak of the British invasion. The Rolling Stones were set to appear on ABC TV's rock music show, Shindig.
Oh, yeah, I remember Shindig.
Right. But they insisted, as a non-negotiable condition of their appearance, that Howlin' Wolf be their special guest.
They insisted.
They insisted. Can you imagine the shockwaves through American living rooms? Here were these sort of clean-cut British invaders, essentially bowing down to this powerful primal bluesman, validating the very roots of rock and roll for a mass audience who might never have listened to blues otherwise. With the Stones literally sitting at his feet, almost reverently, Wolf delivered this impassioned, electrifying performance of How Many More Years? To millions of television viewers. This wasn't just his network TV debut. It was a powerful, undeniable moment of cultural exchange, showing the world the profound debt rock and roll owed to the blues.
That must have been an absolutely electric and deeply symbolic moment. Talk about a passing of the torch, or maybe more accurately, a recognition of where the fire came from, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Later in his career, Wolf also explored some interesting collaborations and experimentations, showing he wasn't afraid to try new things, even as his health started to decline, always pushing his sound.
He certainly wasn't, which speaks to his restless artistic spirit. In the late 60s and early 70s, he recorded albums with other established musicians, constantly seeking new avenues for his sound. One notable collaboration was the Super Blues Band in 1968.
What a title.
Isn't it? Featured blues giants Bo Diddley and Muddy Waters. That was a true powerhouse gathering of legends, an almost unimaginable collection of talent on one record, proving his standing among his peers.
But then came a really experimental and, frankly, quite controversial album, the Howlin' Wolf album in 1969.
Yes, the psychedelic one.
Right. This record integrated psychedelic rock and even free jazz musicians like Gene Barge and Pete Cozy. It was explicitly designed to appeal to the hippie audience of the time.
Or so the label thought.
Exactly. And it had this incredibly bold, almost confrontational cover. It proclaimed in large black letters, "This is Howlin' Wolf's new album. He doesn't like it. He didn't like his electric guitar at first either."
Huh. Can you believe that?
Chess co-founder Leonard Chess himself admitted this negativity was a bad idea for sales that completely backfired. But it shows his willingness to try new things, even if he personally didn't love the outcome or the marketing strategy, which is pretty fascinating for an artist of his stature.
It really speaks to the changing musical landscape of the late 60s and the sometimes misguided attempts by labels to adapt classic artists to new trends. While maybe a commercial misstep, it still demonstrates his openness to new sounds, a characteristic often overlooked.
Hmm.
A much more acclaimed international collaboration followed with the London Howlin' Wolf Sessions in 1971.
Ah, the London Sessions.
Yeah. For this, he was backed by a stellar lineup of British rock musicians, including Eric Clapton, Steve Winwood, Ian Stewart, Bill Wyman, and Charlie Watts. Basically the cream of British rock royalty.
Dream team.
Totally. This album proved more successful with British audiences than American, further highlighting his continued international appeal and the deep respect he commanded from these rock giants who recognized him as a foundational influence.
It was kind of a reunion, wasn't it, with the students playing alongside their master?
That's a blues rock dream team right there, yeah.
Yeah.
A testament to his unparalleled influence. His final studio album, The Backdoor Wolf, came out in 1973. It was composed entirely of new material and recorded with his regular stage band.
It was noticeably shorter, though, just over 35 minutes, which was really a reflection of his rapidly declining health, which, as we'll discuss next, was becoming this significant and tragic factor in his life, making every single performance a Herculean effort.
Yeah, the physical toll was immense by then.
So beyond the towering stage presence and the thunderous howl, Howlin' Wolf was this man of remarkable personal discipline and growth. This is an aspect of his life that truly sets him apart.
It really does.
He was known for his disciplined approach to personal finances, which was, as you said, a rare and striking distinction for a black bluesman of his era who often faced exploitation and lived hand to mouth.
Mm-hmm.
He famously drove himself up from the Delta to Chicago with $4,000 in his pocket. That was a significant sum back then, and a testament to his careful saving and shrewdness.
This financial prudence truly sets him apart, and it's extraordinary when you consider his early life. Remember, the blues scene and the music industry in general for black artists, it was notorious for systemic artist exploitation.
Absolutely.
Many musicians of his generation were routinely cheated out of royalties, lived hand to mouth, and died penniless. But Wolf, despite being functionally illiterate into his 40s, took control.
How did he do that?
With incredible determination, he went back to school to earn a general educational development. A GED diploma.
Wow, in his 40s.
Yeah. And he didn't stop there. He then went on to study accounting and other business courses. This wasn't just about personal enrichment. It was a deliberate effort to effectively manage his own career and finances, ensuring he wouldn't be exploited. He became this anomaly, a savvy businessman in a shark-infested industry. It was about empowerment and self-respect in a system designed to deny both.
That's absolutely incredible. A true testament to his relentless dedication to improving his life and protecting his assets. It really shows that the Wolf was intelligent and strategic, as well as powerful, turning his personal challenges into professional strengths. His personal life also saw a profound change when he met his future wife, Lily Hanley, at a Chicago club. Lily and her family were urban and educated, a background that contrasted quite a bit with the often unsavory and rough-and-tumble world of blues musicians back then.
It was apparently an immediate and deep connection, a true love story by all accounts. He was instantly attracted to her, pursued her, and according to those who knew them, the couple remained deeply in love until his death.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Together, they raised Lily's two daughters, Betty and Barbara, building this stable home life that had been so absent from his own childhood. And Lily became far more than a wife. She was an indispensable partner in his business.
Ah, okay.
With Lily managing his professional finances, handling the books and negotiations, he became so financially successful that he could offer his band members not only decent salaries, but also benefits like health insurance. Truly revolutionary for the time.
That's amazing.
This wasn't just generosity. It was a strategic move that ensured loyalty and top talent.
That's a huge point. And it underlines how his business acumen directly contributed to his musical success. This enabled him to attract his pick of available musicians and maintain one of the best bands in the business, which directly impacted the quality and consistency of his sound.
Exactly.
And despite his financial success, he was never extravagant, right? Famously driving a Pontiac station wagon instead of some flashy luxury car.
Yeah, very grounded. It speaks volumes about his practical mindset. And on a side note, his great nephew, the West Coast Rapper Scheme, carries on a family connection to music today, showing his influence spanning generations and genres.
That's a fascinating lineage. However, despite his personal triumphs, financial stability, and artistic achievements, Burnett faced this fierce and prolonged battle with declining health in his later years. It's a tragic arc, really, given his immense vitality.
It really is. He suffered his first heart attack back in 1969. And it's this really dramatic incident. His guitarist and longtime loyal companion, Hubert Sumlin, actually revived him by ramming a 2x4 into his back when Wolf collapsed against the dashboard.
A 2x4. Seriously.
Seriously. Can you imagine the sheer terror and the desperate loyalty needed to do that? What an incredible testament to their bond and how close Wolf must have been to death even then.
Wow. That's an incredibly intense and harrowing story. It speaks to the brutal conditions and the deep, almost familial loyalty within his band.
Yeah. And just 3 weeks later in Toronto, he experienced additional heart and kidney problems. But incredibly, despite the dire warnings from doctors, he refused an operation, stating with that characteristic Wolf stubbornness that he needed to keep working.
Of course he did.
This just illustrates his unwavering commitment to his music and livelihood, even in the face of serious, life-threatening medical warnings. The show had to go on for him.
His dedication was unyielding, almost superhuman. But fate dealt another cruel blow, a devastating car accident in 1970.
Oh, yeah, the car accident.
Sent him flying through the windshield, causing extensive, irreparable damage to his kidneys. For the rest of his life, he received dialysis treatments every 3 days, a monumental burden, often administered by his devoted wife, Lily, at home. This was a physical and emotional toll that few could endure, let alone continue to perform under.
Absolutely. His health continued to worsen during the London Howlin' Wolf sessions in May 1970, which must have been an incredible challenge to complete, given his condition.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
A year later, he suffered yet another heart attack, kidney failure, high blood pressure. I mean, the list just went on. By May 1973, he was back performing testament to his iron will. But his band leader, Eddie Shaw, had to limit him to just 6 songs per concert due to severe health concerns.
Only 6 songs. Wow. Can you imagine the sheer willpower, the raw internal fire needed to continue performing under those excruciating conditions, knowing each howl might be his last? Almost unimaginable.
It truly is a testament to his indomitable spirit, his profound connection to his music and his fans. That unwavering commitment to his craft, even through such profound pain and decline, is utterly inspiring. His last public performance was in November 1975 at the International Amphitheater in Chicago, sharing the bill with other legends like B.B. King, Albert King, and Luther Allison. Truly a gathering of giants.
And what a farewell it was. He delivered an unforgettable performance, even reportedly crawling across the stage during Crawling King's Nick, receiving a 5-minute standing ovation from an audience just deeply moved by his raw courage and enduring power.
Wow.
Paramedics actually had to revive him backstage after the show.
Oh, my goodness.
A vivid and poignant picture of a man giving absolutely everything he had right up to the very end, leaving every last ounce of his spirit on that stage.
A truly powerful and symbolic exit from the stage, embodying the very essence of the bluesman. In January 1976, he checked into the Edward Hines Jr. Veterans Administration Hospital for kidney surgery. 3 days before his death, a carcinoma was found in his brain, a devastating final diagnosis.
Oh, no.
He passed away on January 10, 1976, at the age of 65, from a combination of the tumor, heart failure, and kidney disease. He was buried in Oak Ridge Cemetery, Hillside, Illinois, with his gravestone etched with an image of a guitar and harmonica, a truly fitting, humble, and poignant tribute to a life utterly devoted to his music and his profound contribution to American culture.
What an extraordinary, challenging, and ultimately triumphant journey. Now let's talk about the colossal, enduring legacy of Howlin' Wolf. He is, I mean, unequivocally regarded as one of the most influential blues musicians of all time.
No question.
He was at the absolute forefront of transforming the rural acoustic Delta blues of the South, that raw, unamplified sound, into the electric urban Chicago blues that became so iconic and influential around the world.
And the musical transformation wasn't static either. It evolved dynamically with his bands and his collaborators. His early sound with Willie Johnson was described as aggressive, featuring raucous, distorted guitar playing that perfectly matched his raw vocals. Later, when the more subtle and innovative Hubert Sumlin joined, his sound became less overtly aggressive, characterized by angular riffing and wild soloing, adopting that distinctive, driving Chicago blues backbeat. This evolution shows a dynamic artist constantly refining his craft, always finding new ways to express his core sound within changing musical landscapes.
And the critics absolutely raved about him, right? Struggling to find words that captured his unique intensity. Cub Coda famously noted that no one could match Howlin' Wolf for the singular ability to rock the house down to the foundation while simultaneously scaring its patrons out of its wits.
Ah. That's a great line.
Isn't it? It perfectly captures his raw power, his intimidating stage presence, and the almost visceral effect he had on an audience. Sam Phillips, who first recorded him, famously said of hearing him, "This is where the soul of man never dies."
High praise indeed. Almost spiritual in its depth. Those quotes truly encapsulate his profound, almost primal, impact. Wolf also played various guitars throughout his career, adapting to the evolving electric blues sound, including an Epiphone Casino, Fender Coronado, and a Gibson Firebird V.
Right.
But it's his K-161 Thin Twin, used in his earlier years, that now resides in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, a tangible piece of his history preserved for posterity, representing the instrument that helped amplify his howl.
His accolades and honors are just extensive, cementing his undeniable place in music history. In 1972, in a full circle moment that must have been incredibly moving for him, he was awarded an honorary Doctor of Arts degree from Columbia College in Chicago.
Yeah, quite a journey for a man who started functionally illiterate, beaten for his inability to read. It's a powerful symbol of his triumph over adversity.
A truly remarkable and richly deserved recognition. His recording of Smokestack Lightning was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 1999, recognizing its qualitative or historical significance as a cornerstone of American music. Mm-hmm. And he's a pillar of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, rightly inducted in 1991 as an early influence. Three of his songs, Smokestack Lightning, Spoonful, and The Red Rooster, are even listed in the 500 songs that shaped rock and roll, illustrating his direct impact on the genre.
That's incredible. His music isn't just influential. It's literally a building block of rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
He was posthumously inducted into the Blues Hall of Fame in 1980 as musician, and then again in 2020 for his comprehensive album, The Chess Box Howlin' Wolf, which is an essential collection if you want to dive deep.
A tip.
He's also in the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, the Mississippi Musicians Hall of Fame, and the Hall of Fame in his hometown of West Point, Mississippi. Talk about widespread, multifaceted recognition across the country.
And it goes even further, right? Into the fabric of American culture, the U.S. Postal Service issued a 29-cent commemorative postage stamp depicting Howlin' Wolf back in 1994, placing him alongside other American icons.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
In his birthplace, West Point, Mississippi, the Howlin' Wolf Blues Museum opened on September 1st, 2005, and hosts an annual festival, ensuring his memory is kept alive and celebrated in the very place he began his difficult journey.
That's great to hear. And to further preserve his legacy and inspire future generations, the Howlin' Wolf Foundation, a nonprofit, was established to provide music scholarships and support blues programs, showing how his influence extends into educational and community work. He truly left a lasting institutional mark.
Absolutely. And for rankings, Rolling Stone magazine ranked him number 54 on its list of the 100 greatest artists of all time in 2011, and number 59 on its 200 greatest singers of all time in 2023. These are massive honors, placing him firmly among the pantheon of musical giants even decades after his passing.
And his influence continues to resonate in modern music, demonstrating the timeless power of his artistry. The experimental rock band Swans, for instance, performed a song titled Just a Little Boy for Chester Burnett on their 2014 album To Be Kind.
Oh, interesting.
With lead singer Michael Jira explicitly emulating Burnett's howling style. This demonstrates that his powerful vocal technique and raw emotional delivery continue to inspire contemporary artists across genres and generations, proving his enduring impact long after his lifetime. He remains a benchmark for raw, authentic expression. #outro.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive into the extraordinary life of Howlin' Wolf. We've journeyed through the incredible, often harrowing life of Chester Arthur Burnett, from a childhood marked by poverty, illiteracy, and profound hardship in rural Mississippi, to becoming the towering, iconic figure known worldwide as Howlin' Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen how his utterly unique voice, his self-taught discipline, his surprising business acumen, and his just unwavering spirit not only defined a genre, but also broke through racial and geographical barriers to influence musicians across the globe.
His transformation of the acoustic Delta blues into the electrified, visceral sound of Chicago blues, his unforgettable, almost frightening stage presence, and his remarkable business savvy, all of these elements culminated in a legacy that continues to resonate with undeniable power. He truly transcended his circumstances to become something monumental, carving out his place in history through sheer force of will and a sound that just could not be ignored.
Howlin' Wolf's story is such a powerful testament to the idea that true artistry often emerges from the deepest struggles, forged in the fires of adversity. It makes you wonder, what does it truly take to not just survive, but to profoundly shape the world around you, even when facing incredible odds, when the system seems rigged against you?
Yeah.
And how much of his iconic howl was not just a vocal technique, but a visceral expression of a life lived with raw intensity and uncompromising spirit? It was a sound that didn't just entertain, it invited you to feel the very soul of the blues, a direct pipeline to a man who refused to be silenced. It kind of begs the question, doesn't it? How many voices, shaped by similar adversities, never found their howl?
That howl was the sound of a man who refused to be silenced, who poured every ounce of his difficult past and powerful present into his music, demanding attention and respect. It's a sound that continues to defy time, a testament to the unyielding power of individual expression against all odds.
Indeed. We hope you've enjoyed this journey into the life and legacy of Howlin' Wolf and gained a deeper understanding of the man behind the legendary roar. Join us next time on The Deep Dive for more insights and fascinating stories, where we continue to unpack the knowledge you need to be truly well-informed.